Hi, everybody. Welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballengee. It's good to have you here with us. It's the week of October the 16th. We've got plenty to talk about this time of year. Things just don't seem to stop in the golf world. And I know that that's always been true. I mean, we've always had events that kind of come and go well into November, even in December, that matter. But it feels just as crowded as ever, even though the PGA Tour feels like it has diminished its fall back to kind of the way that it was from 10 years ago. And we've got the LPGA, we've got the DP World Tour. We will talk about LIV to a degree. We've got the PGA Tour Champions. We've got World Long Drives World Championship this week, which we will have an interview not on this show, but we will have it on GNN Radio around the World Long Drive Championship. So we're looking forward to that. And there's a lot to come in the next couple of weeks of shows. But this week, I do want to start, first of all, with a welcome. And you can get a hold of me, Ryan, at thegolfnewsnet.com. I'm on Twitter, X, Threads, and Instagram at Ryan Ballengee if you want to get a hold of me there. And you can sign up for our newsletter, golfnewsnet.com. Sign up to be a member for $99 a year. We're happy to have you as members, but thanks for being a subscriber to the show regardless. We are going to talk about LIV. And I also do want to make a bit of an announcement. And I don't know if I've announced it on this show. I don't think I've announced it on all the shows, but we will be starting Golf Newsnet Television. That is coming out at the end of the year, either December of 23 or January of 24. And it's going to feature all kinds of great content. It'll be available 24/7 on many streaming services. We're working out all the details of that, but we've got enough now that we can tell you it's coming. And we're very, very excited about that. We'll get you more details as it comes. There'll be some live programming. There'll be live tournaments and competitions that we're excited to announce soon. And there's going to be a lot going on with Golf Newsnet in 2024. So as a guy who started this thing 20 years ago, basically 21 years ago, doing this podcast on Real Media Player, to go from that to blogging, to working full time, to working for myself, to launching the radio station and building the website to what it has become, to have this opportunity is incredible. I can't wait. I don't take it lightly. And I'll get you more details as we go. But you'll be able to watch Golf Newsnet on TV, and that will increasingly include less of me. And that's kind of been the goal over the years. As I mean, I love doing this. I love talking to you guys every week and interacting on social media and doing a lot of the content that I do. But I also wanted to turn Golf Newsnet into a place that was a harbor for great content, and that could elevate great content that didn't get its due and create great content that gets its due. And that's my goal with all of this. So you'll see the promotion of a lot of great golf tournaments and competitions and players that maybe haven't gotten it previously. A lot of great golf content. You might have seen places here and there, you might have heard of here and there, but deserves to be in front of a bigger audience. And to hear from the voices that I think are really interesting and fascinating in our game. Some have huge platforms, some maybe not as much, but I find them very compelling, and hopefully you will too. So that's what's coming down the pipe in the next few months, working on the details of all of that, when it launches, the technical stuff, contracts, all those fun things that we'll just sweep under the rug and someday someone will ask me about. But in the meantime, just want to let you know that was coming. So that's the big announcement for today's show. So let's start with kind of all things where we are on LIV, PGA Tour thing, the world ranking. It's got a lot to digest here, and it all seems to reinforce itself or feed in on each other. So I think it's just worth kind of a segment to bring it all back to where the heck things are, what could happen next, trying to read the tea leaves and read what's public, taking what we kind of heard privately, all those types of things. And it just seems like we are no closer to a resolution of this whole thing than we were in the spring of the year, where it felt like, okay, this thing's just going to keep going for a while, and who knows what the end resolution is. Maybe there's a universe where the PGA Tour, DP World Tour, and LIV coexist. Maybe there's one where LIV goes away. Maybe there's one, then June 6th happens. Really, it's May 30th that happens. But the contract, the framework agreement assigned, and then all of those things change. You think, okay, well, now there's going to be some kind of merger, and some people are saying LIV won, some people are saying the PGA Tour won, some people are saying both won, some people are saying both lost. And I think it's probably closer to the latter two. There were some wins and some losses for both sides in that agreement. But the thought there was eventually, based on the framework agreement and the public testimony of the PGA Tour officials, that LIV's going to go away, Greg Norman's going to go away, LIV will be absorbed back into the PGA Tour. There'll be maybe some kind of team competition in the off season that's maybe running parallel to the FedEx Cup fall, and that's the way it's going to be, and everything will be under one big umbrella. The Saudi money's going to come into the PGA Tour. That's probably going to turn some people off, and then we'll see what happens from there. Well, we're 3 months, 4 months removed from that June 6th announcement, and now it feels like the deal's not going to happen. Now, there are 2.5 months until the framework agreement negotiating period, which is the end of the year, expires. They can agree to extend it. And Bloomberg or FT or both or whatever have run the very obvious story that since there is no deal in place, there's a very realistic possibility they have to do that extension. They have to agree to an extension. And that's part of it. There's a lot of hang-ups here. A lot going on in this deal. There's media rights from the PGA Tour side, from the DP World Tour side. By the way, the PGA Tour owns 40% of DP World Tour or European Tour Productions, so effectively owns a lot of the DP World Tour, even not exactly, but in principle do. And whatever the agreement LIV has with the CW, which was a revenue sharing agreement, they don't make really any revenue, so there's not much to share there. So you have to value those assets. You have to value the real estate that's owned by the PGA Tour, TPC. You have to own or have to evaluate the value of all their intellectual property. You have to evaluate what their archives are worth. You have to evaluate what LIV's players are worth, even though they're a huge liability because of the contracts. You have to evaluate all kinds of different stuff. That's just that. Then you have to evaluate who gets what, how much it's worth, what they're putting in, who wants to put in what. What is the term of exclusivity? How long could that run? Who gets what board seats? I mean, there's lots and lots of stuff to work through, and if there's one hang up at all, then that slows everything down, and I'm sure there's not just one, from what I understand. So if there's not just one, there's a lot to work through. And it might be to the point where it's just not going to happen. Meanwhile, in a side set of conversations, apparently, there are people who are now basically vying for the PGA Tour's attention in private equity because they have decided they want to try to either invest alongside the Saudis or take their place in the investment of this new for-profit subsidiary that was announced that's going to come into fruition as part of this agreement between the Saudis and the DP World Tour and the PGA Tour. But by putting all that out there in the framework agreement, they're effectively saying, look, we don't have any more litigation. It's been thrown away with prejudice, so you're not going to get sued again. You can't get sued again. So that's done and dusted. No one's getting deposed anytime soon. That's done and dusted. Legal bills are gone. We've got lots of money. We got $1 billion coming our way every year in terms of media rights. We're in good shape, but we want more money. And we're willing to take the Saudi money, but we're willing to take it in the form of a new for-profit that we never created before. And that's effectively an advertisement. I don't think it was meant that way originally. Please don't misunderstand me. I think this was a desperation agreement from both sides, realizing that the amount of spilled tea in public court documents and the amount of money they were going to spend suing the crap out of each other, and for what, was a bad idea. But then, as soon as all of that information became public, and people like Ari Emanuel and John Henry and billionaires who love sports and have a lot of money to work got wind of this, they went, well, hey, if you're courting investment, why don't we take part in it? You don't need the Saudis, or we'll do it along with the Saudis, either way, but we're interested. And they started calling up the PGA Tour or getting a hold of Jay Monahan or whoever through an intermediary, Jimmy Dunn, Ed Herlihy, whoever, said, "Hey, what about us? We'd like to get a piece of this if you're going to make it available, some percentage." And that started getting reported through the media, through Bloomberg, as unsolicited, quote unquote, investment offers. Well, then just last week, speaking to Bloomberg at one of their conferences, Ari Emanuel, who is the man behind Endeavor and a company called TKO that now owns the UFC and WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment, he said, "Well, we are one of seven companies to put in a bid for whatever this equity share is that's available." He didn't say whether that's alongside the Saudis. He didn't say whether there could be multiple winners. He didn't say anything about that. Just that they put in the bid and they'll go from there. So I guess they weren't that unsolicited, were they? Because you don't send in seven bids at the same time on a deadline and call that unsolicited. That's called an RFP. That's called a request for proposal. And that's what they got, which is, again, that unto itself is totally fine. If that's what either, I mean, it's not dictated by the terms of the agreement that the PGA Tour would have to only form an agreement with the Saudis involved. They could form this agreement without them, alongside of them. Lots to be determined. So there is a possibility of a variety of different outcomes. And I don't know how much more likely one is than the other, but it sure feels like if the original goal was to have the Saudis be the lone investor with the first right of refusal, one of two things is going to happen. Either the Saudis are involved and they get to pick whose money gets to come in the door with them, or the Saudis aren't involved and they don't like any of this and they're going to be upset. Now, add in the tea leaf that Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who's the governor of the Public Investment Fund, the guy who is the big money behind LIV, right? Well, it's 97% of LIV. That he shows up to the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship 2 weeks ago in Scotland on a week's notice, the invitation of Johan Rupert, who is the CEO or chairman, rather, of the company that is the parent company of Alfred Dunhill Links. He's this guy who's said there needs to be peace in golf. We need to organize this. Meanwhile, saying, "I'd love to get some Saudi money, by the way, to invest in our amateur championships." But nevertheless, he shows up. He wants to play under a pseudonym. He wants to play under the name Andrew Waterman. And then, as soon as everyone real that's there covering it, especially someone, I think it's from the Scotsman, it was Martin Dempster, realizes that that is definitely not a guy named Andrew Waterman, but is in fact Yasser Al-Rumayyan, then it all goes out in public, and then all of a sudden he's on the standard listed as HE, His Excellency, which is something he loves to be called by the LIV guys, which is strange. But nevertheless, he goes and plays, and he goes and plays with Martin Slumbers, who's the chief executive of the RNA. And Martin Slumbers says, "You know, that Saudi money that's going into golf should be embraced and welcomed. And no, by the way, there's going to be a decision on the world ranking points for LIV events soon." And by him acknowledging it, I think a fair number of people, myself included, figured, okay, well, this is a done deal. They're in the world ranking, even though Slumber said he didn't know the outcome of that board vote. Then comes the world golf ranking with Peter Dawson, former RNA executive, now the head of that, goes and says, "Well, no, we're not giving them points. They're not getting points. They're not getting points because they don't have an efficient relegation and promotion system, because 14 of the players, all the captains and co-captains, are protected regardless of their performance. They can't be kicked out of the league no matter what." And two of them would have been kicked out of the league had they not been exempt. Lee Westwood and Martin Kaymer would have been knocked out of LIV after their event this past weekend, but they're exempt, so they're not kicked out. And that also, the Sebastian Munoz, in their event in April, or end of March rather, admitted that he kind of laid up on a putt on the final hole that could have been a tying putt or even a winning putt with a very close finish against Brooks Koepka, because his team had the lead in the team competition and he didn't want to mess that up by being too aggressive with his individual birdie putt. So he made sure he two putted, and even though that's not a guarantee, but that was his thought, obviously, and that ensured a team win and an individual win, second place finish. And that was cited in the letter, like, "Hey, if we can't rectify against the other 24 tours that we rank and offer points to, the effect of team competition on the on the competition itself, much less the protected class of players who may not be really worth anything competitively to the tour, but get lumped in. So now you've got this kind of lack of points, right? And now you have to process that as the next piece of information. Well, if Liv doesn't get points, all of a sudden they don't have as much leverage, because if they were getting points, they could go, okay, well, we don't have to make a deal. We get world ranking points now. We could play our way back into the majors. We could do a whole lot of stuff here. We don't need you. We could just spend our money on ourselves and keep trying to make this thing work. So then there's that part of it. It would also be very awkward if the PGA Tour and the Saudis and the DP World Tour came to an agreement and LIV continues to exist, because LIV wouldn't get points and the PGA Tour and DP World Tour would. Well, that's strange. I don't know how that works, but I guess that's the universe in which it exists, at least for 2024, if that happens. So that's kind of awkward. And then you have the last couple of events, individual events of the LIV season. And the last individual one this past weekend in Saudi Arabia, there's no real permanent resident of King Abdullah Economic City, so no one was really attending, but no one attended. Very few people attended the one before that. It's not good. It's not in good shape as a business. And I think there's a decision to be made here by the Saudis of, do we trudge on and spend billions more after spending billions already and getting nowhere, really, other than an agreement to not sue each other, and maybe if everything works out, a seat at the table? Or do you just go, you know what? If we don't come to an agreement, the PGA Tour, we walk away. But then there's the pride component of that, which I've heard discussed other places, and I agree with. There's the pride of being the governor of a $700 billion private investment fund, a sovereign fund that's going to be worth over $1 trillion soon, being the chairman of one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest, I think the wealthiest company in the world, Aramco, and being had by Jay Monahan. No offense to Jay Monahan, but a golf guy, you're going to be had by him, and you're just going to take that lying down? No chance, right? You'd think they go, okay, well, you want to show that to us? We are going to come after you with the force of a thousand suns. We're going to spend as much as this takes to get all your players away, and then we're going to win. And I don't even think that will work, because going back, you've got that private equity money that's much more palatable. A lot of folks with American flags next to their name instead of the KSA flag. And they're the ones who are like, well, yeah, I mean, if you had told us 20 years ago we can invest in this thing, we'd invest in this thing. We'd have bought it in the Tiger era, is what a lot of them would tell you. And now they have the chance to buy in a world where sports franchises, even ones in less popular leagues, are becoming much more valuable. I'll give you an example. Women's sports has grown tremendously in the last few years. I don't know if you've noticed. I don't know if you watch women's professional sports. I watch some WNBA, I watch some NWSL. Obviously, I watch the LPGA. Women's darts has grown. I watch a lot of that along the PDC. But if you look at the Las Vegas Aces, which is an incredibly successful franchise in its young history in the WNBA, that franchise was effectively bought for a couple $1 million, bought and created. There's going to be a franchise, I believe it starts next year, or it's 25, can't remember, but I think it's next year, under the Golden State Warriors umbrella. They're going to bring a WNBA expansion team to that part of the world. That franchise is thought to have cost like $50 million. So in the space of like 3 years, a WNBA franchise went from slightly more expensive than a lot of the houses where I live, not where I live personally, but in the area where I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, to 30 times that amount. Took no time at all. Same thing is happening in the NWSL, where you could have bought a franchise just a few years ago for a very low seven-figure sum, and that is quickly changing and quickly accelerating. That's why some of these firms have already bought into this Tiger Woods TGL idea of franchises. I have no idea whether this TGL concept is going to work, but it gave Tiger Woods leverage in this negotiation to get him a board seat on the PGA Tour, to basically say to the tour, we don't need you. We could start our own thing, whether it's indoor golf or outdoor golf. We've already got private investment behind us. Either you put me on the board and I deal with the Saudis, or we walk too and you got nothing left. and whoever wants to go to live goes to live, and everybody else comes with us and takes all the ownership stake. And those franchises, four of them have been sold and announced publicly. There are two that are supposed to come. I'm sure they probably got them done, if not all dusted. Meanwhile, Liv hasn't sold anything because that is a toxic investment, at least in this country. So what I'm trying to tell you is the money, the valuation of sports franchises, we may be getting close to peak valuation in terms of the interest and acceleration of that valuation. At some point, this has to level out, you would assume. But in the meantime, while these are playthings for billionaires, they're going to keep bidding them up. They're going to keep getting involved. And the PGA Tour is one of those things you couldn't have gotten involved in. And now you're telling me for the low, low price of a couple billion dollars, you can get involved and own a piece of one of the last big leagues that has that kind of investment available. Done. Done. In. I'm sure NASCAR will see the same thing with teams coming in. More of that. There's room for like another F1 team that'll probably be worth an insane amount of money. All this stuff is there. The money is there. So you don't have to get yourself involved with the Saudis. And there are plenty of people on this planet who would love to have a plaything like that. Enough. I mean, not billions of people, but there's billions of dollars and enough people that control them that want to have these types of things. So you don't need the Saudi money. They could still control their money and do all kinds of things and buy Premier League teams and stuff like that. That's going to continue to happen. They're going to continue to want to get involved, but you don't need them anymore. So does that lead to a doubling down if they're rejected from this opportunity that they've sort of created for themselves and for others? Or they double down on, live and go, well, we're gonna burn it all to the ground. We're gonna make you spend so much you don't have anything left. And how much for the players is enough to just go, well, we just got $1 billion from Ari Emanuel or whoever gets in. We don't need the like 5 billion, especially because all that was lost. That was just money paid and lost. It's no value. So there's a lot to figure out there, but that's kind of the state of play, I think. We have 2.5 months until this thing ends in terms of the negotiating period without an extension. I'm very curious what all that looks like, and we'll continue to follow it. But I kind of wanted to just get everything onto the current day, and then we'll continue to follow it up from there. Go ahead and take a break. We'll be back right after this. If you're like me, you've wanted to buy gold for years. Lots of commercials out there, but who can you really trust? I don't want a bad investment, but didn't want to miss the boat either. Sound familiar? Fortunately, I've got great news. If you have an IRA or 401k and want to buy physical gold, eliminate fear and uncertainty from the process using the new Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist. It helps you evaluate and choose the best gold IRA company. I used it personally to vet Augusta Precious Metals, and they are absolutely phenomenal. Use this checklist to choose the best gold IRA company. Text to get your free Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist today. Text GOLF to 68592. Again, text GOLF to 68592. That's GOLF to 68592. Or go to augustapreciousmetals.com. All right, welcome back, everybody. Good to have you here this week. Second segment, first segment went a little bit longer than I kind of expected, so we'll do three this week. And the second one, I want to focus on Lexi Thompson a little bit and what she accomplished in playing the Shriners Children's Open in Las Vegas last week. So she gets an exemption. It kind of comes together just a couple of weeks prior, apparently, at least based on what she said to Karen Stubbles on the LPGA telecast. She said, it came together the week of the Walmart Northwest Arkansas Championship, which was their first event after the Solheim Cup. She played in that. She played in the one in Texas at the Ascendant LPGA. And she's trying to save her card. I mean, she's not had a good year, her worst season on the LPGA. And she missed a whole ton of cuts early in the year. She needed to earn some points quickly to save her card. And to her credit, she played great. Had a chance on both Sundays to win. She was in the final group at the Ascendant LPGA, even though that was really never hers to win. She was way behind, relatively speaking. And she had the lead for a little while on Sunday in the Walmart Northwest Arkansas tournament. So, season saved. She takes this exemption, decides to play. And as I said on our betting show, I know that there's a huge betting market out there and there's a big number against her making the cut, but here are the reasons why she could make the cut. That she's playing better. She's played against men at many different points in her life, including her brothers who are accomplished professional golfers, and on the PGA Tour, the ball goes farther because the ground is typically harder. TPC Summerlin's played at elevation. It's a firmer golf course, so you get a little bit extra run out. And the PGA Tour is just that way anyway, compared to LPGA events. So she's probably, she might be 270 yards off the tee on average on the LPGA in tournaments where they measure two holes, and she often doesn't hit driver. But on the PGA Tour, she can pop a 300. And that gives her a chance on a golf course that's 7,255 on the card, but really plays more like 7,000 yards. And that's exactly what happened. She gave herself a darn good chance to make the cut. First round was okay, 73, finished it up on Friday morning. The big bugaboo there was three putting from 13 feet for a double bogey. Otherwise, she shoots, 71? So she shot 73 in the opening round, two over. She would have shot even par 71. That's the difference between making the cut and not, plus the next to last hole. So what got her on Friday afternoon, she got to what, four under in the round. She was playing great. It seemed like a very realistic possibility she could get to the weekend. At one point, she was T41. Everyone was loving it. People were tuning in. I think there was a legitimate groundswell of people who wanted to see her make the cut. And then just a couple bogeys coming in. Got to a long par three, which is her next to last hole, the eighth hole. She tries to run one up. She runs it through the green. It was what looked to me like a pretty standard up and down. I mean, it's not easy, especially when you're trying to make history and when a lot of people have got eyes on you. I mean, but if for a weekend game, be relatively easy, but in this situation, not. And we all know Lexi struggles with a short game. And she just couldn't get up enough. She didn't hit a good chip, left probably, what, 8, 10 feet, didn't make the putt, needed an eagle in the final hole. Gave it a good run there in two and had a legit chance about 10 feet left to chip in for eagle to get to the weekend, but ultimately didn't. And even if she had eagled that hole to get to two under, she still wouldn't have made the weekend because the cut was minus three. So really three, four holes there are the difference for her, but to have shot even par, to shot around in the 60s, she did some pretty impressive stuff. I thought it was really cool. And I think for the folks who are going into the week going, well, she's taking up a spot or, should be there, should only be men in the FedEx Cup fall, which I think there's an argument for trying to protect those fields because of the opportunity that's there for players to keep their card. But Lexi Thompson brought a ton of attention to this tournament. And she acquitted herself very well. And while I don't think, like a 74, 7,500 yard golf course, that maybe it's as likely she would do well at this like 7,200, 7,300 number with a little bit of extra run out, she's there. She's competitive. I mean, she did well in terms of strokes gained on the approach. Now, some of that's having longer approaches, right? The measurement is against PGA Tour players, not against LPGA Tour players. So, what you gain with a longer approach on the LPGA is different than on the PGA. So that's something to keep track of. She's also not as long as her peers, so hitting it just 300 yards, which it's weird to say just 300 yards, but in the desert, that golf course goes a significant bit longer. But hitting it 300 yards, she's losing strokes off the tee. What got her was chipping and putting, really chipping more than anything. And that's the difference between getting to the weekend and getting not. I mean, I think I saw enough people in my replies on Twitter or X, that they would be willing to watch her give it another go. And I think there's some value to that. I think there's some validity to that. And I would like to see it personally. I don't want it to get into Michelle Wee territory where she played in eight tournaments over like 4 years and had her best chance to make the cut was really the first one. And then after that, just lots of pressure and it just kind of built upon itself, I think. For Lexi, I think this was an opportunity that she took advantage of and showed people what she is capable of doing. And I think it merits another chance at it. Maybe not this fall, maybe next fall, or maybe sometime next year. I don't know. But I think it would be cool to see again. And all of what she did underscores a couple of different things for me. One, something like the President's Cup should be mixed. Can you imagine how cool it would be to have a President's Cup that's six men and six women from each side, Americans versus internationals. It'd be really cool. Be very tough. It'd be a much closer match, I think, especially because of the Asian influence on the LPGA. But that has waned to some degree as well. The Americans played very, very well this year on the LPGA. I mean, between Allison Corpuz getting the U.S. Women's Open, Lilia Vu winning two majors, Nelly Korda is still an excellent player. You've got a lot of Rozan coming along. You've got a lot of players on the LPGA on that are American that are starting to assert themselves. And it would make it for a really interesting competition. But also that I wish there was some form of a combined event between the PGA Tour and the LPGA Tour. Just kind of a golf festival type thing. They could be competing in the same tournament at the same time from different tees. They could be competing in two different tournaments using a 36-hole course, whatever it is, or 36-hole layout, rotation, whatever it is, the LPGA would benefit tremendously. And I don't understand why there's such resistance to that and has long been such resistance to that from the PGA Tour, especially when you've seen the success of the Scandinavian Mixed on the DP World Tour. Lynn Grant won that going away. She had a proper setup advantage there, but won that going away. And then on the what is now the Challenger PGA Tour of Australasia, they have these events called the WebEx Player Series, where they have men and women competing in the same event at the same time, different sets of tees, same person money. And women have won like three or four of those. So it is possible when you do your best to create somewhat equal conditions that, or somewhat relative to conditions, equal would be the same, relative conditions for competition that women can be competitive with men. I think it'd be cool to see. Don't have to do it all the time, just like once a year. Be neat. I think that if you made me guess, the PGA Tour would be worried that a woman would win. And I don't mean that in a sexist way. I mean that in the way that the PGA Tour promotes itself as the best tour in the world, that if you set up the golf course to be comparatively the same in terms of clubs into greens and things like that, then a woman might win. I don't know that for sure, but I can't better explain why the holdup is or what the problem is. Grant Thornton's come along and sponsoring what used to be the Shark Shootout, making a mixed team thing now, which I think is cool. I think that's going to do well. And hopefully, if it does well, that's the kind of nudge everyone needs here to just do this as an individual event. Team silly season events are fun. Make it worth something. Make it real. I would like to see that. But one of the interesting things, at least I experienced in talking about Lexi Thompson playing the Shriners Children's Open, was it was a tweet I think I sent on, pretty sure it was Friday. It was Friday. It was after she had driven a 296-yard par four. And I've seen over the years enough and played with enough people over the years who are delusional and ranging from like two handicapped to like eight handicapped. We're like, well, I could probably beat players in the LPGA. I could probably compete on the LPGA. And that they're delusional, that you're out of your mind, that this player driving this green, she just did that, and there are people of that ilk on the internet. And you got to get out of here with that. And that's generally true, right? I mean, that world exists. You may not be a part of it. You may be offended that you're a seven or eight handicap, and there are people who are similarly skilled to you who believe that. But I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the people like that who exist. And the litany responses and that were negative in reply. There weren't. I mean, it's a minority. I don't know how many people saw the tweet. I know it got a lot of likes and retweets. I don't know what the final tally is. I stopped caring pretty quickly. But I got two common threads of reply in terms of, I don't know if it's backlash or what, but we'll talk about it. So the first one was, you're making this up. No seven handicaps ever said that. No six handicaps ever said that. And I'm like, no, I mean, those people exist. I've seen it. I've heard it. It's been there. It's happened. So, live with that. And guys would go, oh, you're just making that up to. There was one guy, he's Australian and went to the University of Maryland, which really puts a stain on my degree, I suppose, and said, oh, you're just doing this to promote women. And I was like, well, I mean, Kind of am trying to promote the LPGA. I've been promoting the LPGA for 20 years. But then if you look at someone's Twitter profile in this kind of group of folks, a lot of commonalities. And one of those commonalities was some blatant sexism. And the guy sent two tweets that kind of summed up that this general backlash point of view pretty well, I think. Not everybody, but generally. And that was that he tweeted at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I don't care what you think of her politics, whether you are hard left leaning, mid left leaning, mid right, hard right, neutral, doesn't matter. But he said to her in a tweet that she needed to stop talking and make him a sandwich. And then tweeted to someone else in response to Lexi Thompson related content. I'm a two handicap. And I promise you, I'm better at her job than she would be at mine. And that's that point of view. Then the other kind of trope of tweet was, well, it's really not that impressive to drive a green from 296 yards. And unto itself, I suppose that's true, right? I mean, there are plenty of golfers in this world who can hit the ball 290 yards and run up on the green, or 296 exactly, or even longer than that. That was a big part of point missing. That's part of this. Because I got a bunch of replies. Guy was like a 12. He's like, I'm a 12 handicap. I've driven a 320 yard green once. Yes, that happened when you were playing with your friends on a golf course that wasn't conditioned for the PGA Tour. No one was watching. No one cared, including yourself. So you driving a 320 yard green, that or 290 yard green, is not the point. The point is that you're doing it on a PGA Tour caliber course, with thousands of people watching, knowing there's a ton of pressure on you, knowing that world-class pros are playing against you, knowing that it all counts, and knowing that there are a lot of people that are rooting for you to fail somewhere. You couldn't do that. You wouldn't even sniff it. You have no chance. And so I got a bunch of people who are trying to explain to me why hitting a 296-yard drive is not impressive. And that again, unto itself is true. I mean, I routinely hit drives well over 300 yards. I've also played golf for almost 30 years, and I'm a plus player. So, unto itself, being a dude who hits a 300 is not impressive. However, if I were playing at a PGA Tour event and I had thousands of people watching me, even if I had like five people watching me, and I drove a green for 296 yards, I'd be doing the Happy Gilmore dance because that would be a tremendous accomplishment. And that's the thing people don't understand. They don't understand. At least these people didn't understand, I don't think. They didn't understand the value of pressure. They didn't understand the value of the kind of course they were playing, the situation they were playing. They just assumed it's all the same task. There's no difference. And I promise you, there is a very dramatic difference. I mean, if you've ever played with people watching you, I don't care whether it's a pro-am, your club championship, a buddy trip, the second people start watching you, it's different. And the second start people watching on you and are rooting against you or betting on you, then it gets really different. And when eliminations and losses can happen in front of people, then it gets extra different. There's a lot of nerves, whether you show it or not, in that type of situation. And that's the thing I think people miss. That, and that's the thing I think Lexi did a really good job of. And she has not been particularly great in pressure situations at times. And when she melts to the pressure, she has not necessarily responded well in the past, where she said, well, I'm not going to do a media interview, or I don't have to answer that question about that shank chip or what have you. She did a really good job here. She handled the pressure well. She kept her messaging clear. Said, look, I just want to be inspirational to people, particularly to young girls, to see what they can accomplish and put themselves up against the best of the best and put your talent up, believing that you're one of the best. And give it a try. And she beat 40% of the field and proved it. I think that's wonderful. She did a great job with that. And hopefully, this is a springboard point for her moving forward. I don't know that it is or isn't, but I thought this was a mission accomplished kind of thing for this tournament, for this week. And I think this is exactly what the fall is meant to be, an opportunity to kind of experiment a little bit while also getting to have a winner like Tom Kim, a repeat champion, Third PGA Tour win, youngest guy to win three events since Tiger, first guy in the modern PGA Tour to be 21 or under and repeat on the PGA Tour. John McDermott won the 1911 and 12 US Opens. They count that as PGA Tour recognized events, but obviously there was no PGA Tour then, and the US Open at that time was like 40 guys. So a little bit different of an era. And you get those types of stories happening together. I think that's kind of powerful and cool. Are many people paying attention to this fall? No, definitely not. The audience is maybe one tenth what it is normal week on the PGA Tour, but that doesn't mean you can't have a cool story. So I think that was a good watch, and hopefully you enjoyed it as well. We'll go ahead and take a break. Be back right after this. All right, let's wrap everything up this week with a little LPGA talk. Not Lexi Thompson playing on the PGA Tour, but actual LPGA Tour competition, which Lexi will be returning to, I assume, with the Annika, which is their last domestic event. I don't know if she's playing any in the Asian Swing, but they were in their first event of the Fall Asian Swing over the weekend in China, and this was the Buick LPGA Shanghai, a tournament they hadn't played since 2019, basically in the COVID era, and we're back and they're trying to wrap up this contract. I assume they had, I think, 18 or 19 of the world top 50. Next week, they have like 39 of the world top 50 in South Korea. So there is some reluctance probably to play in China as well. Nevertheless, Angel Yim played in the tournament, and she was one of the higher ranked players in the field. And it was an interesting tournament all the way through. Maya Stark gave herself a good chance to win. She backed down a little bit on Sunday. Lilia Vu's a part of it. Angel Yin's a part of it. And eventually, Angel Yin and Lilia Vu get into a playoff of 14 under total. And they get to the first playoff hole. And she wound up, Angel Yin did, making 8-9 footer for birdie to win the playoff and beats Lilia Vu, who Lilia Vu beat Angel Yin in the playoff to win her first major of the year, the Chevron, in April. And so now they're not exactly even because Angel Yin would have had a major if she had won, not her first LPGA Tour title, but Angel Yin now is an LPGA Tour winner in 159 starts. She first started playing on this tour in 2017. She's been around. This is year seven of her being on the LPGA. She's just 25 years old. She came right out of basically high school. I don't even remember her playing college. She might have played college very briefly, but got on the LPGA. She's been on three Solheim Cup teams already, which is kind of crazy to believe, but she got on this year's and had been on the one at what Colorado Golf Club and the one after that, I think, and played twice for Julie Inkster. And Angel Yin cited Julie Inkster as one of her motivators, one of her inspiring things that got her the win. And she said Angel Yin talked about changing her mindset a little bit and trying to deal with her emotions on the golf course. Because on the golf course, she tries to keep everything neutral, Angel Yin. She tries not to get too high or too low. And I think that's what a lot of people have been taught in the wake of Tiger Woods' success. You need to be able to control your emotions and control your thoughts and really control your ups and downs emotionally and physically so that those deviations don't come at the worst time and you don't do well. And Angel Yin said that she was basically inspired by Julie Inkster to do the opposite. So Angel Yin says, quote, "I've been speaking to Julie Inkster about it. I don't really feel much emotions on the golf course." She was like, "No, that's not good. I want you to get mad again. I got a lot of emotions and I started doing again, and I started playing well. That helped me a lot to be able to be expressive and not just flatlining on the golf course. Growing up, everyone taught me to be stone-faced, no emotions, poker face. I don't think that fits me. What fitting me right now is doing, or is I'm doing to express myself." End quote. And I think this is interesting for different golfers, and this is true of you and me, is trying to figure out the best way to approach golf from a performance perspective. And then she even took it a step further and said, hey, she was watching the final of the Shanghai Masters, which I believe is an ATP 1000 event. And there was a match between Andrei Rublev and Grigor Dimitrov. And it was a really interesting match. Dimi is supposedly kind of starting to kind of come back on the scene. I don't follow tennis week to week as well as some other people, but I do follow a fair amount. And she must have been really inspired by the match. She said, quote, just getting into tennis. And I was watching the first match and then the second match, Rublev, and it was a really tough match against Dimitrov. And I just saw him like express himself very well on the court. It wasn't like he was just completely emotionless. It's like, I've been thinking about that a lot last night, and then today I started out pretty mellow. Not much, kind of flatlining, nothing was happening. I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to draw on my emotions. And end quote. And that worked. And then when the it was really interesting, when she made the birdie putt to win over Lilia Vu, there wasn't a whole ton of emotion. I mean, the putt goes in and she just kind of stands up and smiles. Like, it's done. I did it. I finally accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. And stories like that are things I love about golf. I mean, I love seeing people's hard work pay off because I'm obviously obsessed with working hard to try to build something, to see it grow and pay off at different stages and in different ways. And so I'm very much drawn to those types of things. I'm drawn to people who are successful, who put in the work and be long-term success, but also people who just get their day in the sun. I hope for Angel Yin it's more toward the first of getting more wins, and now that you've done it, you've popped the Pringles can, you can't stop, kind of thing, as the old commercial goes. And I hope that's the case for her. But regardless of whether it is, she figured out something that allowed her to be successful. And I think there is something that we as golfers can take from all of this. I think there's a tremendous value in trying to understand just exactly what you need to do on the golf course to be successful in terms of emotion. Now, obviously, if you don't have a good skill, if you don't have good technique, you don't really know what you're doing out there, it doesn't really matter what your emotion is. I think I would tell you, if you're not a good golfer, and that can mean just for these purposes, if you're a 20 handicap or worse, and you're struggling to break 90, then I would say emotion is a hindrance. Negative emotion is a hindrance. Don't get mad. Why are you getting mad? You know you're not good. Just enjoy it. Try to have fun. Take value, enjoy from the signs of improvement that you make and those times when you have good holes or a good stretch of holes, be happy about it. But if you're a player who's seriously trying to improve or is a serious golfer, then you have to figure out how emotion, you can leverage emotion to help you on the golf course. And I'll give you a personal example. So I tend to be on the golf course very laissez-faire, kind of like Angel Yin, not stone face, but it's kind of is what it is. I mean, it's not like this is my job to play golf. It's not like I haven't done things I've wanted to do in golf. I mean, I've had some really great rounds, broken par, I've had a plus handicap, all those types of things. I'm very happy with what I've accomplished in golf, and if I never do it again, I'd be totally fine with all of that. And so I play golf that way. I think in some ways to a positive at times. Where I go, okay, it doesn't really matter. There's no pressure. Nothing can stop you because you've done what you've wanted to do. And sometimes that works out really well. But there are other times when you get particularly lazy and you go, well, it doesn't really matter. This 6 footer doesn't matter. This 5 footer doesn't matter. This chip doesn't matter. This wedge doesn't matter. Just hit it. And that's a negative because then I don't put the proper attention and interest into that shot. I don't invest the right kind of work ahead of the shot, whether that's putting in a good read or putting in a purposeful stroke or really thinking about what I want to do with a shot through the air or on the ground. I just hit it and then, oh, well, it didn't work. And then just try to shrug it off. And if you're having a good day, you don't have to shrug off many. And if you're having a bad day, you shrug off a bunch. And some days when I don't have it, I won't play well for long stretches of time, half the round. And then all of a sudden, something will change. I'll finally hit a good shot and I'll play the next 5 or 6 holes unbelievably well. I mean, I had a I've had rounds like that where I snap in for like the last 6 to 10 holes, and you wonder what could have been if you just stayed really engaged from the get-go. And I'm trying to figure out that balance now personally. And friends have noticed that when they play with me, like you've been a lot more sure-handed on these shorter putts or certain shot types where sometimes you're kind of so-so about them. You've really been good with them lately. And I said, well, that's because I've really put effort and attention to accomplishing those shots better, playing them better. And maybe it's a mixture. And I think that's maybe something Angel Yin is kind of talking about here. Not letting your emotions get controlled or control you on every shot, just knowing when to care, knowing when to be emotional, knowing when to get mad, for how long to be mad, for how long to be happy. We talk about that a lot in golf, being mad, because it's an imperfect game and you're a fool to think you're going to be perfect. There are going to be times you get frustrated. But I think at the same time, and I've heard professionals talk about this too, you have to manage your happiness on the golf course. When you're playing well, you want to be happy, but you can't be too happy, right? Because if you get too happy, then you rest on your laurels and you maybe make a lazy swing or stroke. And it's not that you don't care. It's not apathy. It's that you're just kind of happy with what you've done, so the present doesn't mean as much. That happens a lot. But also managing your happiness when you're playing poorly, that or relatively poorly. Take, for example, a round where you're playing okay by normal standard, right? But whatever your normal standard is, whether that's half pars, half bogeys, bogey golf, lots of birdies and eagles, whatever it is, you're playing okay, but you can't get anything going. You have to kind of decide, do you want to get mad because you're not doing it, or it's not working, or you're lipping edges, stuff like that? Or do you want to be happy because it's relatively easy for you? Or another example, I played not too long ago. I played really well the day before, and I thought, all right, I'm going to come out again, and I'm just going to smack it around. I'm going to do it. I'm going to try to shoot my best ever round. And I did not have it. Absolutely did not have it. I played in a money game, play with strokes. Usually stroke, when I'm giving up a lot of strokes, is it's hard for me. That's something I need to improve upon. And started pressing right out the gate. Just didn't have it. But I figured out how to be happy because on hole after hole after hole after hole, I made, a 10-footer to save par. I'd get up and down from somewhere. I got up and down from 85 yards to save a par. Like, just keep the pars coming. And then it kind of turned on a little bit in the middle of the round because I was grateful and happy that even though I didn't have my best stuff and definitely didn't have what I thought I was going to have, I figured out a way to make it effective. And eventually it snapped into gear for 3 or 4 holes. Things went really well. And I played okay down the back stretch. It was a pretty decent round. Not my best round ever. Had some sloppy holes in the back. Had some equipment problems too, but had some sloppy holes. But I was really proud to take away that I could clearly not have it and still be productive. And it's so interesting how golf, your emotions are important in golf. It really is important. And the difference between being mad and being motivated, the difference between happy and being fat and happy kind of thing. All that stuff comes up so often. And I know there's great resources out there, a lot of good podcasts out there talk about the mental game. Dr. Rob Bell has one on our network that's really interesting called Mental Toughness. And there are others out there that are very good. And I'm not that kind of person that consume that kind of content. I need to figure it out for myself. And I just kind of wanted to pass it along because I saw her comments and thought they were very interesting about trying to let, how do you leverage emotion in a round of golf to your benefit? And that it's a lot more complicated, I think, than just having no emotion or riding the wave too much. That there are times for each, and figuring out that mixture might lead to some better performance and better scores. All right, that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. I appreciate it. If you like our show, leave us a 5-star review, leave a comment, helps us reach more people. We'll be back with a guest probably next week. I think we're going to have a guest next week. Don't hold me to that, but I'm pretty certain we will have a guest next week. And we'll have another show. We'll probably keep doing this through the beginning of December, maybe around Thanksgiving is when we'll call it for the year. Here on the 19th Hole Golf Show, we'll keep doing two off the first well into December because there's just day-to-day news and things like that to talk about. But we'll probably cut this off at the about a month and a half from month and a half from now for the year. And then we'll be back for 2024. Thank you so much for your support. I appreciate it. I'll get more news to you about Golf News Net TV as it's available. And we celebrate in 2 weeks the 1 year mark for the launch of GNN Radio. It's been really cool to have that year go by so quickly. And we start year two with, we've got five new shows we just launched on the network. So check them out when you have a chance over at golfnewsnet.com on iHeart or TuneIn. I'm Ryan Balaji. Thank you for listening. We will catch you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.